The 2006 Sunstone Symposium Arizona presents Session 7, Mind Over Matter, Spirit versus Flesh, The Problem of Embodiment, the Divine Feminine, and the Position of LDS Women, a plenary address by Margaret Toscano, chaired by Doe Daughtry, with opening remarks by Ken Morrison.
I'd like to remind everybody that to turn off your cell phones and your pagers and anything else that might make noise. You can put it on vibrate if you want before the session starts. Read that again for the tape. The plenary session, Mind Over Matter, Spirit versus Flesh, The Problem of Embodiment, The Divine Feminine, and the Position of LDS Women, with Margaret M. Toscano, Ph.D., I'd like to welcome both Margaret and Dr. Kenneth Morrison from the Department of Religious Studies. I'm going to turn the time over to Ken to make some brief welcome comments, and then I'll introduce Margaret, and she'll share her paper with us.
Hi, I'm Ken Morrison. Can you hear me? I'm not used to doing this. I lecture and just boom. My students think that I'm a whack case. I think that's working better. I'm here this morning to welcome you all to Sunstone on behalf of the Department of Religious Studies. I am an Americanist. I'm trained as an American historian, and I'm a specialist in Native American religions, and so I'm very much excited about the conversations that's going on about the study of American religions in the context of our program. To me, the study of Mormonism is absolutely essential, and I've had such a good time in the first two sessions this morning. So I want you to know that I'm personally very happy about this. But I specifically want to thank the Kenneth E. and Becky L. Johnson Foundation and H. Michael Wright for the financial support that has made this possible. This is really a great thing. I also want to thank Dan Witherspoon. Where is Dan? There you are. Of the Sunstone Foundation, an old former student of ours. It's homecoming for some of us, right? And I want to thank Doe Daugherty and Laura Bush. Where is Laura? Right there. All of the hard work that they have put into making this conference a go. Really a lot of work. I also want to take a minute just to share some issues and perspectives about why I think this is such an important conference for us at ASU. I won't take a long time, but I think that you need to understand that Arizona State University is not your grandfather's university any longer. In fact, the cultural change that has taken place in the last 3 years since Dr. Michael Crow became president of this university has been absolutely amazing. And I think that it's relevant to say a few words about that so that you understand the nature of the conversation that we're having. I think that Mormon studies is religious studies. But of course, I have a very particular take on what religious studies is. One of the things about what we are now calling the new American university is its commitment to local embeddedness. This means that we are being encouraged, and for some of us it's like, wow, at last, being encouraged to make our research relevant to the communities that we live in. This is really, really, really very, very exciting. There's another emphasis that the university is taking as a whole, and that is that we really ought to have a contemporary focus. We need to think about an intellectual life that is relevant to the world in which we live. That means that we are concerned with local culture, pluralistic culture, in a place like Arizona and in the Southwest, in a way that we've never been before. Some of us have. I mean, we've worked as isolated individuals. But the new model is to have scholarship address local situations. But it's even more complicated. It's like, What week is this and what new institution has been invented? We now have the Center for Transborder Studies in relationship to the Latin American studies, in relationship to Chicano studies, in relationship to American Indian studies. Mormon studies hasn't arrived yet. I personally am keeping my toes crossed. But in addition, of course, ASU has ambitions to work internationally, hemispherically, and globally. And I'll say a few things about that in a bit, because, of course, I see Mormonism in all of those terms. For religious studies itself, this has been an incredibly exciting time, because these developments have come just as we've established a PhD program in the study of religion. Of course, that program has a strong Asian emphasis that's really important. But as an Americanist, I want you to know that the Native American thing is particularly relevant. We just came from a session in which we were discussing Native American religion in relationship to Mormon missionization and those kinds of issues. I learned a lot. It was really, really, really great. Religious studies, of course, articulates with traditional subdisciplinary interests like Jewish studies and, as I said, with American Indian studies, Latin American studies, and those kinds of things. But what is also really interesting and I think relevant is a new school in the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences called the School of Global Studies, which is an transdisciplinary collaboration to bring us together in conversation. In fact, you'll see that there are several initiatives that are really important in that regard. The School of Global Studies says on its website that it's transdisciplinary in strategy, that it is transnational in scope, and that it is transformational in purpose. Sounds like Mormon studies, doesn't it? It means to address, and again, this is the contemporary and the practical emphasis of the New American University, decision makers in government, business, non-governmental agencies, and policy bodies. So this is a really significant initiative, and one of the very interesting things is that the School of Global Studies has its own faculty, but they also have homes in traditional departments, so that we're now living in a new world in which the discipline of religious studies is just not adequate for describing the nature of our work. In addition, we have a new school of human evolution and social change, formerly the anthropology department. I mean, this is a new thing. You notice anthropology is not in it at all. I want to read a little statement that they make on their website so they understand the difference. Quote, "Globalization and a variety of demographic, economic, and other trends are rapidly converging to completely transform our world. As it becomes more interconnected and complex, new intractable problems emerge in almost all domains. It thus becomes overwhelmingly important to better understand how individuals, groups, societies, and nations can relate to one another, shape their environment, and organize themselves so as to counter religious chauvinism, factionalism, environmental conflicts, and the many other threats to the coherence of any society on earth." This is anthropology with a difference. It's a very, very exciting time at ASU. In addition, religious studies is very closely related to one of the very first things that President Crow created with the advice of the Religious Studies Department, and that is the Center for the Study of Religion and Conflict. The Center for the Study of Religion and Conflict understands itself as promoting cutting-edge research and education on the causes and dynamics of religious conflicts with the aim of contributing to their containment and resolutions. Now, This also is a kind of scholarship that is new. It's transdisciplinary, it's collaborative, it doesn't know traditional disciplinary boundaries. The center is an amazing thing in that it's bringing people from all over the university, and indeed the world, into conversation with each other in a way that has never happened before. It sees itself as a research hub. It sees itself as transdisciplinary, collaborative, and it sees its work as relevant to national and international life. Wow, so that's the context. We're having a really exciting time at ASU when we're not exhausted. All of this to me, and this is my personal take on it, because I care very much about this conference, and I really care about how people can come into conversation with one another. Mormon studies is relevant to the new American university, it seems to me, simply in our need to recognize Mormonism as an American religion, as an American Christianity. And we could open up the box and ask, well, what does that mean? To say that Mormonism is an American religion is not to say much, right? I mean, partly because as an American religion, it was one thing in the 19th century, and it's another thing in the 21st. That's what we're here to learn about. And that's an absence, I think, that I feel very acutely. Equally, I think it's really important to understand, and this is crucial for us in religious studies, in this department of religious studies, because of our American emphasis and our insistence that we understand American religion not as a national phenomenon, but as a hemispheric one. Okay? Mormon is a Western religion. It is a religion that is rooted here, in this place, over an extended period of time. And part of our investigation of religion in the American West has got to take into account the nature of Mormon experience. And that's right across the board. But in addition, there is no doubt that Mormonism is also a hemispheric religion. Things are rapidly changing in Latin America. It's like a lot of us spend a time going, what's that about? I mean, liberation theology was in place. You know, John Paul comes along, and the anti-Marxist that he is very nervous, and suddenly we've got a kind of religious change that Catholicism is not paying attention to. Pentecostalism is a huge religious movement throughout Latin America, and certainly the presence of the Mormon Church is amazing. We need to understand that. And then, of course, undeniably, Mormonism has become a world religion. It is there and everywhere. What I find interesting, and that I personally don't understand as a scholar, I don't see it in the textbooks for sure, is that what is really going on in all of these situations, the American context, the Western context, the hemispheric, and the global, is that Mormon folks, people, are interacting with other people. So in my case, I really would like to understand, and I don't, the conversation that has taken place between Mormon missionaries and Native American peoples. But equally salient to our understanding of this region, we won't understand it unless we understand this, is the Latino-Hispanic-Chicano connection. We don't get that. I want to say one last thing. I think that you can understand that I'm having fun today. This has been really, really good intellectual exercise. I spent the last few days chewing around Sunstone magazine and looking at the work of the foundation. And I was completely blown away. I found it fascinating that Sunstone began in 1975, the year I got my PhD. It's a big year for me. It was a big year for me, too, because I got out of Maine and the provincialism of that place and landed at UCLA, where social and cultural history was just beginning. I was trained as a diplomatic historian, long ways from religious studies. You know, the kind of study that concerns movements and trends and all of that kind of stuff, great white men, etc. And I suddenly was at UCLA, where the emphasis was now to understand people, which I didn't recognize then, but was the beginning of my movement towards religious studies. I think this is the distinctive thing that we do. I look at Sunstone, and I am delighted and blown out of the water simultaneously. You look at the journal in recent years, and you find the most amazing and thoughtful and carefully researched considerations of aspects of Mormon culture that I deeply appreciate. No one can spend any time at all with Sunstone magazine without understanding that Mormonism is not mono. The name of the game is pluralism and diversity and contestation and thinking issues through. But Sunstone is also important for another reason, and that is because since 1975, it has been creating a record of Mormon thought and life. I mean, there's poetry in there, there's news in there, there are obituaries in there. This is an absolutely essential resource. And I appreciate, in appreciating Sunstone magazine and for what it has to say about the study of religion in the West, I really want to convey how much I am having a really exciting time at this conference, and let's keep the conversation going. Thank you very much for all participating.
Well, I hope, I feel like I can actually forgive myself for being so flustered at having to stand up here. I can talk in front of anybody and, you know, give my own papers, but having to introduce two people who have been so influential in my both personally and professionally. Yes?
I forgot a very important thing.
Well, I forgot to introduce you, so.
And that is that one of the emphases. One of the emphases of the PhD program that we're working on in that model of collaborative and transdisciplinary research is a theme that is also a conference that's going to take place here at ASU on March 3rd and 4th. It's called Through the Lenses of Race and Ethnicity, Revisioning the Religious History of the American West. You all want to be part of that conversation, and you're welcome to join us. Tisa Wenger, put your hand up, Tisa, is one of the organizers of that if you want to know more about it.
There's a flyer out there, too.
And there's a flyer out there for the particulars. You can go to our website and find out more. Okay, thanks.
So, yeah, now you see how great he is. I don't even have to introduce him. It's really wonderful to have that kind of enthusiasm when you go to talk about Mormon studies or a project that I'm interested in doing. But now I'll turn my attention to Margaret. Margaret Toscano is an assistant professor of classics at the University of Utah, where she also received her PhD in comparative literature. She co-authored the book Strangers in Paradox with her husband Paul, and she is also the author of many articles on theology and feminism, including Is There a Place for Heavenly Mother in Mormon Theology? It was the cover feature of the July 2004 Sunstone magazine. She is one of the founders of the Mormon Women's Forum, and each year organizes and hosts the Counterpoint Conference. Her work on gender and in Mormonism spans decades and continues to influence new generations of scholarship in LDS feminism, including and especially mine. So I'd like to turn the time over now to Margaret Toscano.
I'm very pleased to be here today. I want to thank Sunstone and ASU and the donors for this conference for making this possible, inviting me. Especially, I want to thank Mike Wright. He happens to also be a cousin of mine. There he is, Mike. I am actually an Arizona girl. I grew up here. My family was an old Mormon pioneer family here in Arizona who settled in the 1870s. they were really the first pioneers in Arizona, Mormon pioneers. I went as an undergraduate to BYU, and I'm afraid to say that I sort of became a Utah person after that. So, but whenever I come to Arizona, I feel a lot of nostalgia. And I'm very excited also about what's happening here at ASU with religious studies and Mormon studies. Unfortunately, at the University of Utah, people are very nervous about talking about religion, even though I find that my students are very interested in it. What I would like to do with you today, and in some ways, I'm going to try to wear several hats here, and I'm hoping it's going to work. On the one hand, I mean, we have an academic community here, but we also have other people who don't have a lot of training in academic religious studies, and I'm going to try to balance speaking to both of those groups. I'm also wearing the two hats of being both a scholar of religion. I did my PhD in comparative literature, but my topic was medieval women mystics. And really, my major area of research is women and religion in several different contexts. I sometimes like to say that I've studied so many different things. I've studied so much that I've almost become nothing. You kind of, if you go to everything, you become nothing. And I feel like that sometimes. But I'm very interested, especially in Western culture, about the kinds of stories and symbols that we create to create a picture of the world and how those influence how men and women are positioned in society. I'm interested in myth and in patterns that that influence our constructs of reality. So the two other hats I'm also wearing here are that on the one hand I am a scholar of religion. This is my academic area. And yet I'm also an activist. I'm a feminist activist, I have to say that. That I care deeply about gender issues in the Mormon Church. And in fact, gosh, I didn't know I was going to get emotional. I was excommunicated from the LDS Church for being outspoken. I can't believe this. For being outspoken on women's issues. And with as a person who had, you know, six generation Mormons, Mormon in the church on every side, this was very difficult. So you can see me getting emotional that although this is in a way a scholarly topic, it's also a personal topic. And with the exciting discussions that we've been having here this morning on the topic of religion in the academy and religion in Arizona and so forth, I think it's very important, and maybe so me kind of getting a little tearful here is a good thing, because in fact, one of the big issues in the academy right now that has come about because of, in a sense, our postmodern sensibility is the fact that really none of us is completely objective, and that as scholars, we have a position, and that it's important for us to make our position visible, that position is that's an important thing to do, and that we can't escape the political. That even though I'm going to talk a little bit today about some history of theology, it's a very political issue, and I want you to see that. And so another two of my hats that I often find ironic is that as a Mormon feminist, I am creating primary documents. That when I first started out my interest in trying to find out about the divine feminine in Mormonism, there aren't a lot of resources. And in a way, some of the work that I've done is trying to create those documents. And at the same time, I'm a scholar who's trying to look at those documents. And this puts you in a very strange position sometimes, that you're both the source and also the objective scholar at the same time. And it's a very odd sort of thing. But you'll see a little bit of that here today. What I want to do today with you, and I guess another one of the hats is I'm going to try to be the teacher here a little bit as well, is that I'm trying to complicate a question for you today. Now, if you read my abstract, I had that long, awkward title, Mind Over Matter, Spirit Versus Flesh, The Problem of Embodiment, The Divine Feminine, The Position of LDS Women. But really, my central question is this. Why think of God as gendered? Okay, that is my central question. Why should we think of God as gendered? Does it matter? Does gender matter in the question of how we picture God? Now, when I have argued over the years for the importance of the Heavenly Mother in LDS theology, and I'm going to come back to this, but I think I should say right now for some of you that don't have a background in this, that really Mormons will, I think I can pretty much say that Mormons will agree that the doctrine of the Heavenly Mother is orthodox. President Hinckley himself has said, yes, we believe in a Heavenly Mother. So that, in some ways, is a common ground that Mormons share. The contested ground is what position she holds. Now, also, as I talk about this issue of why think of God as gendered, I think there's an interesting tension that's developing in Mormon culture. So on the one hand, we have this foundational Mormon belief that, yes, God is gendered in the sense of there's a Heavenly Father and there's a Heavenly Mother. This is considered orthodox doctrine. And at the same time, I think there's a growing nervousness about talking about God in gendered terms, especially in terms of a Heavenly Mother. So part of my question here is, why is there that growing nervousness about talking about the Heavenly Mother and about talking about God as gendered, even though there are many ways in which this fits into a larger tradition in Christianity? So as part of my complication for helping you to see how this issue is complicated, I want to put the issue of the embodiment of the Heavenly Mother in the context of Christianity in general, the problem of embodiment, this transcendent God versus the immanent embodied God in Christianity. And so I'm going to try to connect those two things for you. So when I have said to people, you know, that I've talked about the importance of the Heavenly Mother, and as I've said, people have said to me, why think of God as gendered at all? Isn't that something literalistic and naive? How can something as large as divinity be limited to something so grossly earthly as a body with genitals? And one of the things I've found in talking about this over the years is that I think it's the genitals, in a way, that start getting people nervous. And so one of the questions I want to ask you, or have you to think about in this, is, you know, we've talked about God as a he for thousands of years, at least in Christianity, a couple of thousand or more. And yet, this has not been one of the major issues, except for with the embodiment of Christ. On the other hand, why is it that when we talk about the Heavenly Mother, we suddenly get nervous about the gender and maybe the genitals as well? So in this discussion today with you, I want to explore the ramification of that question. You know, why is it that we often think of an embodied God as something inferior to a God beyond categories? And why, on the other hand, I mean, we say that we have this God sometimes beyond categories that people want, and yet that God is often referred to as a he. So my other question here for today is that I want to talk about embodiment and ask the question, is it necessary to redeem embodiment in order to redeem the idea of talking about God as gendered? Now, my next point is this. In feminist theology, which really got going in the 1970s, I think it's interesting that a lot of interest in issues, political issues, got started in the 1970s. A lot of feminist theologians began to argue that in order to really bring about gender equality for women, that we needed to get beyond the language, the specific language of he and gender in talking about God. For example, Rosemary Radford Ruther, who's a very big scholar in this area, she has a book called Sexism and God Talk, and this is one of her major points, that she talks about getting beyond this language of sexism in God Talk. So the next question that I think that leads to is this really going to help women? That's the question. If we get to a picture of God that goes beyond gender, is it going to help women? Now, in order to answer that, I think we first have to explore the question of why is it anyway that we often seem to think of the transcendent God as superior to an embodied God? Now, as I said, in Mormonism, I see a tension here, because if you look at mainstream Mormonism, a very orthodox belief is that Mormons believe in a God with body parts and passions. This is in Mormon scripture. We believe that God has a body, that Jesus has a resurrected body, and we believe that in a literal resurrection. On the other hand, I see more and more a tendency in Mormon discourse to use language that describes a God that is more beyond the body. So I want to contextualize this for you and put this discussion way back. Really, the problem of the embodied God, the fact that we see that as a problem, goes back to the ancient Greeks. The ancient Greeks, of course, any of you that took a basic class in mythology, which I teach at the University of Utah, if you know about the Greek gods, you know, they're these anthropomorphic gods, they're very sexual, they have beautiful bodies, right, the Apollo, Aphrodite, and so forth. And they also have these passions, and sometimes their behavior is not what we would like. And so, at the very beginning of the birth of Greek philosophy in 6th century BCE, you have some Greek philosophers who begin to question the traditional Greek religion that had these anthropomorphic gods. So I have a little quote here from Xenophanes, who was an Ionian Greek philosophy of the 6th century. He says, "Homer and Hesiod have attributed to the gods all those actions that are shameful and blameworthy among men, stealing, adultery, and deception of each other." And then he goes on to describe how that really, if you look at a comparative view, he says, this Greek philosopher, that he argues that really we're just making the gods in our own image. And he says, "The Ethiopians say their gods are snub-nosed and black, while the Thracians think theirs are blue-eyed and red-haired. If cattle and horses and lions had hands and could draw and make things like men, horses would draw their gods in the shape of horses, cattle theirs in the shape of cattle." And then in contrast, Xenophanes argues for a different kind of God. He argues against that, this anthropomorphic, polytheistic God, and he says, "There is one God, not like men in body or thought. He remains perpetually in the same place, utterly unmoved. It is not fitting he should go to different places at different times. Without effort, he causes everything to move by the thought of his mind." Now, I want you to notice a couple of things about that quote. First of all, the idea that he feels like that somehow perfection is in a state of stasis, being still. Also, that it's connected with pure mind and oneness. And then I want you also to notice, and this of course is a translation, but it accurately depicts the Greek, that he still calls, even though he wants to get beyond the anthropomorphic God, he calls this God, this unmoved God, he. He uses the masculine pronoun, nevertheless, to define this God. And that's very interesting for this discussion today. Now, I want to go to some of my own reflections about why it is in the history of Western religion and definitely influenced by Greek philosophy, that we have tended to see the idea of a transcendent God beyond categories as somehow superior. And I'm sort of asking this maybe more in the negative. Why is it we dislike the idea of an embodied God? And I've come up with a list of 10 things. I'm hoping that we're going to have enough time for some discussion at the end. And so any thoughts that you have on this at the end, I want lots of response. But these are my ideas. First of all, I think that our preference for a God beyond categories reflects our fear of passions and the urges of the body. That we often see the body as the source of sin. The second thing, it shows our shame for our physical natures that go against what we sometimes see as our better selves. And of course, Paul, in his letters in the New Testament, very much reflects this with the contrast between flesh and spirit. You know, that what I want to do sometimes I'm not able to do. And the big argument in religion is, what is it that is the cause of that? Number three, we connect our sins with emotions like jealousy, anger, and desire. And so, of course, we want to get beyond those Greek gods that have all of that. Four, such a God reinforces, that is, a transcendent God, reinforces the desire for a neat, rational type of goodness that doesn't have to deal with thorny issues like sexuality. I mean, if God is embodied, what do we do with sexuality? I mean, isn't this a real source of problems? Five, it shows our longing to transcend the problems and mundanity of the everyday. Six, it is our response to our fear of death. It is the hope that we have a soul that survives. So to believe in a transcendent God is to go in that direction. Number seven, everything alive and moving dies. I mean, this is one of the definitions of something that's alive, right? As it moves, and yet that change leads to death and decay. So we feel the need to get beyond the physical to become immortal and beyond pain. Eight, the God beyond everything also seems to encompass everything and thus include it. And so such a concept offers unity. I mean, if you look at religions that have a transcendent God, there's a way in which it unifies. Nine, I believe that it may also hide the fear that there is no God, a God who is not physical and who is beyond all categories and comprehension can't show up. So there's no way that we can prove or disprove the idea. If God has an address, then you should be able to go find him there, right? And finally, 10, a God beyond categories may be easier for institutions to control. Now, I already mentioned that I do a lot of work with medieval women mystics, and there's a scholar by the name of Sarah Beckwith. She's actually a Marxist, but she's done a lot of work on the medieval women mystics. And she talks very eloquently about the way in which the question of transcendence and the definitions of God and mysticism are intertwined with the struggle for control over sacred power. The desire to see God, this is her argument, that the desire to see God and mystical discourse in idealistic, transcendent terms is to cloud the connection between economic, political power, and the representation of the Word of God. It is in the favor of those who are profiting from the Word of God to represent it in otherworldly terms that are removed from a social context where motives as well as categories are mixed. And I think this is a very important point that we need to ask, who has something to gain by picturing God in a certain way? Who is going to benefit by this? Now, I want to now flip to the other side and say, well, I mean, maybe it was already self-evident to you. You know, why is it that this picture of the transcendent God is so appealing? But I want to go to the other side and ask the question, well, what about an embodied God? I mean, what is it about an embodied God that can be appealing? Even though maybe most people assume that the other is more natural. The only way in which I have heard people argue that the embodied God is more appealing is the notion of the personal God. And I think it's very interesting that if you go from academic discussions of the issue of the nature of transcendence versus immanent to more everyday discussions of God, that people talk about God in very embodied personal terms. Now, not usually the God with genitals, right? But the God that is very personal. Because, of course, I mean, what is a basic human need? That we want a God who can comfort us, that can understand our pain, and that can help with our everyday problems. And so this is where we find the language that talks about God as embodied and personal. In addition to this, I think there are a couple of other things that one of the big problems that religion has had to deal with, especially if you look at the history of Christian theology, is that we've got to explain why in the world did God create, if you believe in God, why in the world did God create this vast physical universe? And this is not an easy question to answer in the history of religion. One of the answers, and one of the women mystics that I studied in my doctoral work, was a woman by the name of Mechthild of Magdeburg. She was a German woman who lived from about 1208 to 1290. And she's not alone in this argument, but part of her reason is that she explains the creation of the physical world, because, of course, for a tradition, the issue is, well, if God was perfect and God was one and God was absolute and had all of this wonderfulness, why did God need to create a physical universe? Well, Mechthild reflects the response that a lot of Christians have had, which is God needed somebody to love. And so God created the world so that God would have another person to love. Well, that's a good answer. But on the other hand, it raises interesting questions, because it says if God needed something, does that mean that God was insufficient? And for Mechthild, and I want to come back to this, she also pictures God as lover. Her God is very sexual. And she depicts, I believe that she uses the sexuality because it's in the sexual metaphor that need of God and the worth of the soul, she's also interested in the worth of the soul. One of her questions is this. Again, if God is everything, if God is so wonderful, why in the world did he create this pathetic little me? I mean, all I am is a sinner. I'm so pathetic. Why did God create me? And for her, the idea that God has this passionate desire for her is the only explanation that she can come up with. And so she, in fact, creates a very embodied God. A next thing, of course, which I've already implied, is that the embodied God values individuality and personhood. And so the notion of a God that is immanent, embodied, gives value to human personhood, which I just explained with Mechthild as well. She wanted to find value. I mean, why do I exist at all, she says to God. I mean, all I do is sin. How could you want me? And it's in that her own personhood that God wants her. Now, the next thing is that there's a way in which embodiment values diversity, because it moves out of the singularity of God, where God is the singular thing that needs nothing outside of itself, to value diversity. And my fourth reason is that, in fact, and of course it's already implied, if God is physical embodied, then the value of embodiment is reinforced. Now, I won't have time to discuss this as much as I would like to in some ways, but the problem of the hatred of the body in Western culture is huge, in my opinion. Absolutely huge. As somebody that also teaches about Greek religion, I have often asked my students, what would it be like to have a god of sexuality like Aphrodite? I mean, that could be kind of really wonderful if you had a god that actually liked sex, right? Maybe it would make it so that we didn't hate sex and hate ourselves because of our sexual feelings. So, you know, this is something to think about. And finally, an area that we don't often think about, but an embodied God also values the idea of representation, visual representation, iconography, symbolization, and sign systems. one of the big debates in Christianity was always the issue of, can you picture God? And Augustine, St. Augustine, who lived from, 354 to about 430, something like that, probably my dates are wrong, but about that time period, he was one of the first ones that argued, and in a sense against Jewish tradition, that we're going to picture God, because in fact, and what was his argument, if any of you have studied this, his argument was the incarnation of Jesus Christ. He said that because God chose to become physical and come down into his creation, this therefore values the whole idea of artistic, visual representation of the divine. And I see this as a very important important part of this argument. So in fact, my next point that I wanted to make is that as we look at the advantages of an embodied God versus a transcendent God, that really all of those reasons that I've given you have been argued by theologians, that all of those exist in the person of Jesus Christ. That one of the great appeals of Christianity as a religion is that, in a sense, it has both the transcendent and the immanent God. It has the embodied God in Jesus Christ. That he is the, Orthodox Christianity says that he is both fully human and fully divine. Now, I want to quickly complicate that in two ways. First of all, even though Christianity in general has said God is fully human and fully divine, there have been heated debates about that. Secondly, this then brings up the gender issue, okay? Because as soon as you have a Christian religion that says we're embodying God in a male body, a male Jewish body, the question is, does that mean that a male Jewish body is better than a female Ethiopian body? Okay, that is the question. And it's a difficult question. Does it of God as Jesus as male, and the question of the problem of this flip-flopping between the human and the divine? Again, in the history of Christianity, we've not been comfortable with the body. Very quickly, there were Christian writers who wanted to take away all of the kind of human experience of Jesus. I mean, they got nervous about stuff like Jesus going to the bathroom and Jesus having sex. And, of course, we quickly made him into the eunuch, right? And historically, I mean, the question is difficult to know whether or not he actually was married or had sex. The Da Vinci Code right now has been, a huge popularizer of this question of whether or not Jesus was sexual. And, of course, it's going to come out in a movie form now, and it's going to just start the debate going even further. I think it's interesting that in Mormon culture, if you go back into 19th century Mormonism, there are clear statements by Brigham Young that Jesus was indeed married. It's also interesting that we downplay that now. Why is it that Mormonism is afraid to talk about that? Is it connected to our desire to be part of mainstream Christianity? I have just a quick little anecdote here that a friend of mine told me. This was several years ago, but this was back when he and I were both students at BYU, and we were all excited about, finding out all this stuff about Mormon history. And he'd never heard this in Sunday school, that early Mormons believed that Jesus was married. And so he decided, he somehow got an appointment with Marquis Peterson, who was an apostle at the time. He went up and he asked him, was Jesus married? Is Brigham Young right? Mark E. Peterson's answer, which I don't think he wanted him to say out to the world, was, I think Jesus was above that. Well, this was very troubling to my friend, because he said, well, if Jesus was above that, what about eternal celestial marriage in the temple, and I have a wife, and all of this? It was, again, the same kind of problem. But I tell that story to illustrate that Mormonism, on the one hand, has a doctrine that values embodiment, and yet there's always this movement away from it, and so the question, why? Just quickly also, in talking about movies and popular culture, any of you who, if you saw a long time ago, the movie The Last Temptation of Christ by Kazantzakis, it was based on a novel by this modern Greek writer, and the filmmaker was Scorsese, the big controversy in that film was the idea that Christ was tempted not just with wanting to have sex, but that he was tempted that he wanted to get married so that he could be normal and live a normal life. And one of the interesting little things about the controversy over that film is that really the film and the novel support the idea of rejecting the body and that he had a higher purpose, and yet just the idea that Christ was tempted was shocking and appalling to people. Now, I won't have time to develop this fully, but I want to, my next point I want to make is that you can already see with what I've outlined that in Western cultures, one of the big problems we've had in religion is the problem of what is called dualism. That, I mean, a dualism can mean many things philosophically and religiously, but I want to define it right now for one aspect of it, which is this tension between the spirit and the flesh or the mind or the body. And the question here is, are humans one substance or are they two? And again, I don't have time to go into all the complexities of this and how this impacts our sense of our identity. And again, traditional Christianity has said, well, Jesus himself was fully human and fully divine. Of course, the idea is that you're going to get beyond the body, beyond the human, and go back to the divine. Mormonism has tried to marry those and has tried to say that we can do both. We have an embodied God. He's also a God of glory. He has powers that are beyond that. But still, we've tried to balance that between the body and the spirit. I think that I sense personally that right now in Mormonism, we're tending more toward the area of the spirit as superior and starting to see God more in terms of transcendent terms. But I don't know, we could argue about that. Now, why is this important for my initial question, which is God gendered and does it matter? That if we look from ancient times about this dualistic split between mind and body and spirit and flesh and, you know, which is better and are they equally better and so forth, one thing that complicates this is that way back into Greek philosophy, we have a list of dualities where on the one hand, we have God as creator and spirit and mind and reason and substance and active, this active principle. On the other hand, we have creation and flesh and body and emotion and form and passivity. And that duality has been split into that the God, spirit, mind side has been linked up with the male and the creation, body, embodied side has been linked up with the female. And so, and it's very, very pervasive in all of Western culture, in texts where you wouldn't really even know that it's there, such that this problem that I'm talking about, embodiment, becomes very much a gender issue, because the question is, if we do not value the body, if we do not value these things, and whether they really should be linked up with women is another issue, but they have historically. And so the question is, if we make that split, if we value one over the other, is it going to always lead to a denigration of women? Okay. Now, I don't have time to give all my quotes, but we could start back with Aristotle. I mean, Aristotle himself, if any of you have taken a class in gender studies, I mean, I love Aristotle when he's talking about poetry. When he's talking about women, I have more problems with him. He connects women with the bodily. He also connects them with an inferior, and there are certain places where he calls them as incomplete males, that they have not developed fully into the place that the male has. Just a quote, "The element that can use its intelligence to look ahead is by nature ruler and by nature master, while that which has the bodily strength to do the actual work which he links with women is by nature a slave, one of those who are ruled." So women are suited by nature for their private role in the household because they are naturally inferior to men and should be obedient to them. Well, obviously that also comes down into Christian discourse. Now, so my next point is that, of course, and I've already referred to this, that feminist theologians have often argued that the way we can solve the gender problem is we've got to get rid of the duality. I mean, this duality has killed us, right? So let's get rid of the duality. Again, Rosemary Radford Ruther is a big name there, but really, this is not just an argument in feminist theology, but in the academy in general right now, the whole notion of duality is sort of one of those bad guys. And it's a lot of, you know, things are directed, you know, Descartes, for example, and his, you know, cogito ergo sum, you know, he's often, I was talking to a colleague the other day who was teaching a class in Western Civ, and, you know, he was starting out with sort of knocking down Descartes and this mind-body split. So my question is that really the answer to the problem, to get rid of the dualities, which in a sense is to get back to the transcendent, that we're going to transcend the categories in some way. Now, of course, in the academy right now, the idea is not that we're going to transcend the categories, but we're going to more focus on the bodily. So my next question is it possible for us to do this? I mean, I wonder, when I hear the discourse on how duality is really the enemy, that duality creates hierarchy, and it's true that it can. I mean, if you have mind-body, and then you want one to be superior, right? So, but is it the duality itself? One of the things that I worry about is that duality is so ingrained, at least in Western culture, although I think, you know, even in other traditions with yin and yang and so forth, that you have it there, that it's very difficult for us to get beyond that. For example, I mean, if you look at just the human body, two arms, two legs, two eyes, two nostrils, I mean, this notion of pairs is so much a part of embodiment, in fact. We could also talk about, you know, even with our computers, the idea that, you know, that really the whole idea of a computer is built on an off-on switches, that again, a sort of duality. Now, my next point is that some feminist theologians have argued, well, if we don't get beyond duality, maybe we can at least argue for a kind of androgyny, where we combine, especially with God, both male and female characteristics. And again, it's interesting in the context of the women mystics that I looked at, this was often a something that happened in the medieval monastic world, that a sort of androgyny was valued because it seemed to get beyond the kind of sex issue. You had the sort of eunuch that was also an androgynous creature. There is one scholar by the name of Barbara Newman who very perceptively, as she examines the idea of androgyny, and she says, well, really what happens in androgyny is that, and the monastic movement is just a perfect example of this, that you still have the masculine that dominates, because androgyny itself, she used plays on the word, androgyny, andros is the Greek for male, gune, like gynecology, is female. And she says, just like in the word itself, androgyny, if you look at monastic androgyny in the medieval world or back with the Gnostics, it's still the male that dominates. And as she points out, the woman who unsexes herself, this is actually my paraphrase of her, the woman who unsexes herself in order to be on an equal footing with men is the only androgen in the group, since men can remain virile in their virginity. The idea echoes Augustine's view that only the male is the complete image of God and therefore needs no female. The female is not the complete image. In other words, in the monastic culture, the idea was that you gave up your sexuality, but the males still kept their gender. So I'm making a distinction here between gender and sex. My next point that I want to make here is that, and I've already alluded to this, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it, that historically, if we look at it, the transcendent God does seem to encourage hatred of the body. Now, I want to quickly now go. I've given you the sort of framework. And again, what I've been trying to do is to complicate the problem in Mormonism, to show that, you know, to simply kind of try to get beyond the language of male and female God does not solve the issue of gender in any way. And let me talk about how in Mormonism I see this manifest in several ways. As I've said several times, Mormonism, the theology of Mormonism says, yes, we believe in an embodied God. And also, as part of this, it says that, of course, men and women can become like God. This morning there was a very fine paper, Bo Siegmuller, is that your name, gave a very fine paper on polytheism and the problem that often Mormonism has been accused of polytheism. And, of course, one of the problems here is that that's a very loaded term, that polytheism, very much like I've tried to show with Greek religion, this anthropomorphic Greek religion, was seen as something inferior that Christianity wanted to get beyond. But Mormonism does have in its doctrine, even though we're a little bit nervous about it now, the notion of that humans can become God, like God in some way. How that is under debate, right? But they can. And as part of that, we say there is, in fact, a Mormon document called the Proclamation on the Family, which has been, I think, almost canonized, really, that says that gender is eternal. Now, this creates a big problem in Mormonism from a feminist perspective, because you can say, well, again, if gender is simply something that is for this world, then maybe eventually we can get beyond it in the next world if gender isn't there. If in Mormonism gender is eternal and you have this male and female, then the question is, are we going to also perpetuate into heaven the same kind of relationship between male and female that is here also into the eternity? Now, I want to connect that with the mind-body problem. If we look at the language about the division into roles of men and women in the LDS Church, it very much seems to dichotomize into the typical kind of men over here with the mind and women with the body. The Proclamation on the Family says that the eternal role of women is to nurture, which seems to imply this connection with motherhood and with the mothering role. Now, I don't have time to develop this fully, but certainly, I mean, nurturing could have a much broader application to it. It talks about the role of men as to preside. Now, what I want to suggest here, maybe this will lead into our discussion, is that I believe that this divide into these roles does create a sort of mind-body split, but in an odd way where women get the short end of the stick in both ways. Okay, let me tell you why I think this is so. Okay, on the one hand, we have the role of women as defined to nurture, which puts them into the private realm. And so their job is to take care of those physical things. The men have the role in the church to lead the spiritual affairs, right? They have the priesthood and lead the spiritual affairs. And so we have, in a sense, the men in charge of the spiritual things, the women in charge of the physical things that are there on one level. On another level, of course, the church is a physical organization that has a lot of things to it that are like housekeeping, right? I mean, you have budgets, you have all sorts of things like this. And so, of course, the men get as much involved in the physical as they do in spiritual affairs. On the other hand, women, even though their role is to nurture, and there's this idea, there's a lot of discourse in Mormonism about women should stay home and so forth, and yet women have a very vital role in terms of helping the church organization run. I mean, they basically run the children's organization, and there's the Relief Society and the Young Women's. Whenever I talk out on gender issues, people always tell me this. Women have a very important place in the Mormon church. Look at all they do. But here's where it gets complicated, and we start getting the categories kind of falling apart on one level and yet used to maintain the gender dichotomy on another level. And that is that although women have this role in the church, in terms of the church organization, they do not control the budgets or the policies. That all of everything that women do in the church they have to get permission and answer to male leaders. And so part of me says, well, if really women's eternal role was to nurture in the church, if we really believed in that on one level, shouldn't we let Mormon women actually have the sort of ironic role of organizing everything and controlling the budget and letting men do the spiritual? But we don't do that. On the other hand, I see this discourse flip-flopping, because when I've talked about women in the priesthood and tried to bring up arguments where I think that in Mormon text that there is justification, and in the Mormon temple for women having priesthood, I'm often met with the argument that women do not need the priesthood because they are more spiritual than men. And so we have a discourse that says, on the one hand, that women don't need to have this kind of leadership role because they're more spiritual, and yet we also need them to do this physical work because their role is nurturing. So I, in a sense, this is my argument, there's a way in which the discourse kind of turns against women in both directions. Now, I want to quickly take this, I'm trying to leave enough time for questions here, I want to quickly take this to the issue of the Heavenly Mother, because I think there's a way in which the Heavenly Mother and the way she functions in Mormon culture is similar to what I've described with women, where there's a way in which she gets the short end of the stick in both ways, too. That my good friend Doe here wrote a wonderful master's thesis, and did you end up calling it Bodies, Parts, and Passions? Wonderful master's thesis here at ASU, in which she talks and traces the disappearing discourse on the Heavenly Mother. And from my perspective, it's very troubling that as you look at references to the Heavenly Mother, they're sparse all the way through Mormon history. But in the last 15 years, basically, they've become even sparser. And she does seem to be disappearing, even though there is still the belief there. And the question is why. Now, Doe comes up with several reasons. I mean, one of them is maybe the obvious reason, that it's a reaction to feminism, Mormon feminism, that holds on to the Heavenly Mother as an empowerment for women. It might be a reaction to that, but I think a more persuasive argument in Doe's thesis is that the Heavenly Mother, in a sense, is an embarrassment. And here, my contextualization of the embodiment problem. That the Heavenly Mother, as soon as you have a Heavenly Mother, we have sex and embodiment and anthropomorphism and polytheism, which are all brought back into Mormonism, and an embarrassment that if we want to be considered mainstream Christian, we've got to get rid of. And I think that this is a very persuasive argument that Doe makes. I want to go now even one step further than this and say that that I think that the implications are even larger, because it goes to this issue of our nervousness about embodiment itself, not just about being part of mainstream Christianity, but about embodiment itself. That on the one hand, and this is where I'm saying that the Heavenly Mother gets the sort of short side of the stick. I'm very bad at cliches. That on the one hand, we have the Heavenly Mother, using the proclamation of the family, who's reduced to biological motherhood. On the other hand, she is spiritualized away, where the reason that is often given that she cannot be represented is that she's too sacred and that she's too spiritual. And so we can't represent her, we can't talk about her, we can't embody her in our discourse because she's too sacred. And yet it seems that what she's doing is up there having babies and changing diapers. And so we sort of have the two extremes that are almost contradictory and don't make sense. One argument I've also given about, you know, this idea of, if indeed the role of the Heavenly Mother and of women eternally is to nurture, then why do we write them out of the creation story? Just last year, President Hinckley gave a talk in conference about the value of women, and he used the creation story and talked about how Eve was so important and so wonderful in the creation, that she was the culmination of creation. And I was very pleased that President Hinckley wanted to talk about, that he talked about the value of women, and that he did so much to try to argue against any kind of sexism. And at the same time, he describes a cosmic creation where the creator gods are three male gods. And my question is, if this feminine role is so valuable and the nurturing role is so valuable, then why don't we have the Heavenly Mother as part of the create, that she's helped in the creation of the universe? And if this role of nurturing is so important, then why don't we have a council of mothers in the church who make sure that real nurturing happens in the church? Well, I do want to leave time for questions, so let me just quickly, one last thing, and I haven't fully answered the question of do we need to redeem embodiment in order to redeem women. I hope that you can see from what I've talked about that I think that we do. From my perspective, I think that if I had my way, I would want to argue for the value of both sides of the duality and for plurality. I think it's only in the plurality that we're going to be able to value the diversity of both males and females and of the diversity of Mormon culture. Someday I want to write something about my picture of the Heavenly Mother. Personally, I picture the Heavenly Mother as a very beautiful black woman. And I like this idea of diversity that goes on into the eternity. And even though sometimes when I talk about the Heavenly Mother, people assume that I'm naive and do not understand all the problems of embodiment, I'm going to continue to talk about her because I believe firmly that we need that our language is such that in order to talk about what is the most real and divine, that we have to use language that includes the diversity of experience of LDS people. Thank you very much. I think we have about 15 minutes, so please, I would love comments or questions. And yes, and please, in fact, maybe I'll... I love to play.
Me or her?
I can do it.
Hello?
Hi. Professor Toscano, aren't you getting it really your way in the Declaration on the Family as the language has changed from Heavenly Father, not to Heavenly Mother, but to Heavenly Parents? And the very notion of the word parent maintains two sides of the sexual, but also a partnership. And as Joseph Smith, you know, in his own early time, how could you have a father without a mother? I mean, the need of a partnership that seems to be, as I've told you before, pregnant within our religion, that we'll have other sections of the Doctrine and Covenant forthcoming where we amplify what heavenly parents are. And you'll get it. You'll get this, the Heavenly Mother and the Heavenly Father, as it becomes more interesting to the brethren and sister.
Yeah, I really appreciate your question, and that Randy and I have had this discussion before. I agree with you that there is plenty, not just in historical Mormonism, but also in contemporary Mormonism, that we could use to really promote the equality. And certainly in the proclamation, it does talk about parents. On the other hand, I don't have the proclamation with me, so I can't go through and show you the language, but it's almost like it's what I was saying about this kind of slipperiness, that it goes back and forth. It says parents, and then it quickly, maybe you can remember, Doe, how it does, but it quickly goes back and talks about father and focuses on the male. And you say, it talks in there about a heavenly father, but it does not say heavenly mother. It's true that there's a place where it says parent and parents even, I think, but it switches back to the male so that the female disappears again. So I agree with you that there's a lot there that we could use. My worry is that we keep downplaying that. Another example of this, and I haven't been to church for quite a long time now, so maybe some of you can help me with this, but the young women's model, where they say, we are daughters of a heavenly Father who loves us. I mean, that to me is very troubling. I mean, why can't they say we are daughters of heavenly parents and our heavenly Father and Mother love us? You know, why do we slip back to the male language again? So I agree with you on one level, Randy, but on another level, I just think that it's being, whatever we have is being removed, is what I'm worried about.
I want to make a comment, and I guess I come from a sociological perspective in terms of my profession. But I think the Divine Mother is extremely powerful. I mean, in terms of the feminist movement and bringing Christianity in line with feminism, and I kind of in my own mind kind of think that within the Mormon Church, that concept is such a revolutionary concept that it can redeem Christianity and bring it back. Because I think within traditional Christianity, we have totally neutralized the feminine. I guess the Virgin Mary within the Catholic Church, particularly in Latin America, the exaltation of that. But I see embodied within the Mormon Church this fantastically powerful the Divine Mother that actually can be redemptive for Christianity if the LDS Church would just pay attention to it.
Do you understand?
Yeah, I understand. And of course my question is, why don't we? I mean, even with the Da Vinci Code, I think it's very interesting that you would think that we would sense that there's a real interest in this, but there was a series of lectures.
We'd exalt that.
Right, but it hasn't been. So maybe I should throw the question out to you, some of you. Why do you think it hasn't been? I mean, there it is. Why isn't it?
Well, beyond all the speculation, it seems anyone who's interested in gender equality, any Christian, it seems to me that Christianity is beyond redemption in this arena. That, honestly, because Jesus was a male and he was made divine by Nicaea councils and things like that, and you're never going to get beyond that. You're always going to be hung up on the fact that whenever humanity knew of an embodied God, it was a male Jesus. It was a male Jesus God, and I just cannot see beyond the speculation of him marrying Magdalene or whomever you like. We have no way of knowing. All that Christianity is left with is a male Jesus.
Regarding your question of why Christianity may not be willing to embrace the female goddess, in my experience talking with Christians, they're very offended by the idea that God would have sex. They're very offended by the, I think you referred to the ancients who were uncomfortable with the weaknesses of the physical and so forth and the vices and everything. But I mean, people today want our leaders to be perfect. They want the President of the United States to be perfect. They want their prophets and leaders to be perfect. Their whatever your popes, whoever, they need to be perfect individuals in our perspective, and they're very offended by the idea that God could ever have had sex. They're very offended by the idea that he has a physical body. It's not something you can even talk to most people about.
Well, and but my response is always, why do we say sex sins as worse than greed or power? I saw a really funny email where somebody
listed all what they thought, you know, George Bush had done that was wrong. On the bottom it said, would somebody please give him a blowjob so we can impeach him? And, I mean, I think that's very telling in the sense of that, you know, we're, you know, why is it we think somehow that sexual sins are worse? I mean, it's a very telling thing again. in terms of how we view. I would like to answer, maybe you'll have to, Ray, why don't we talk more about the Heavenly Mother? Why are we nervous about that in Mormonism? I think we are. Maybe you disagree with me.
But there was a response here.
I have basically 2 points on what you've said. The first has to do with, I think, the historical context of Mormonism, which essentially built on the Judeo-Christian theme and took the Bible as the basis and then added the Book of Mormon. So you have that historical context, which has not changed, and it would be difficult to do because of the Bible being part of the basis for Mormonism. The second, and to me the most important thing, and what I always have problems with, is we as a Western society refuse to either accept or certainly acknowledge or endorse or take part in Eastern culture societies, the Midwestern culture societies, where women play a significant role. If you go into the Hindu religion, there are multiple gods, many of whom are women. South American societies have matriarchal societies. Mid-Eastern societies have matriarchal societies. We ignore those. And so if we wanted to look at it from that context, would we not be able to say that take it one step further, and if you want to put it into a religious context, which you can do in the Eastern religions, there are women who are gods in that society. But we live in a Western society, not in a world society.
In response to your question about why can't we talk more about Heavenly Mother, last week we passed out the new Wilford Woodruff manuals to the Sisters in the Relief Society and had a lesson on the introductory information for this year. The timeline and the autobiographical information in that book do not mention that Wilford Woodruff was ever married. There's no mention made of a female or of a child in that introductory material. So if we can't talk about women in our church, physical women who lived, how can we talk about a mother in heaven?
I think we don't talk about Heavenly Mother because there have been authoritative dictates against it. And when I was teaching in the English department at Ricks College, which is now BYU-Idaho, I had several incidents in which things were reported about me going on in my classroom. One of the things that happened was I was brought in by an authority of the church, or of the school, to ask if I had been teaching about our Mother in Heaven. And I breathed this sigh of relief. No, I hadn't been teaching about a mother in heaven. I'd been teaching about other things, which I hadn't been accused of. But this thing, I had been accused of, and I could just, you know, easily say. So there are authoritative kinds of pressures against it. That's one of the main reasons.
I think that's true. Just a second. I was here at the New Paul.
I had to teach one of those lessons out of the new manual, and it was vile. What I found really interesting is that I've found that men can talk about Mother in Heaven without any reprisals, without any eyebrows going skyward. It's my former bishop, stake president, mission president. He's a pretty high up there guy. Gets up every Mother's Day in our ward and talks about the wonderful relationship that he has with his Mother in Heaven, and he can do that. And I think if I got up and read his remarks word for word, the scandal would never end. But somehow he can do that. And maybe that's the backdoor way in to making it okay for discourse for everyone.
I think your question was because I've been thinking about what everybody's been saying too, and I'm old and I can't remember what people say anymore. But I think that the reason is because women are a slave class, and they have to be kept at that position, and they are a slave class in the church, and we don't want to face this. The idea that Heavenly Mother should be on an equal footing with Heavenly Father and the Godhead is subversive to this idea that women should be in a slave class. A society needs a slave class to do the menial work and not be paid, or else the society will collapse. And that's true of the church. It's everywhere present in the church. And the fact that people leaders of the church allow this to continue in the name of Jesus Christ is a blasphemy of the first rank. And to answer your question about Jesus being a male, it is true he was a male. He wasn't a very good male. He allowed himself to be crucified and bleed to bring forth a new birth. I myself am not sure that Jesus is the Christ or that he was a deity or that he even existed historically. But I can read English. And what the New Testament says is that Christ came to a tribal religion and turned a tribal war god into a cosmic god of love and transformed a tribal religion into a universal religion where everybody had an equal footing and claim upon God. Now, the fact that we can't see in that, the fact that women should not be a slave class and that the LDS Church is not vigorously advocating that throughout Christianity, which I think was its principal role, shows that we have simply collapsed into a kind of heresy where we just want to perpetuate the inequalities of the past into the future.
Thank you, Margaret. I had an interesting experience in college as a student. One of our professors, she graduated from Villanova with her PhD. She's from Philadelphia. She's Catholic. And she was hardcore in feminism. You know, she's quite a professor. She had an interesting class where she brought in the proclamation to the family, whatever, as a text to be studied and interpreted by the students. And there were a number of LDS students in the classroom who claimed authority to interpret it, whereas they were not allowed, other people, including women in the class, this is a feminist class, they did not have the authority to interpret. Like, this text was not open to interpretation to the female sex. And that was just an interesting observation by our professor when she brought that in, and it was something to mill over. So authority might be an issue as well.
I the question is, why the role of women and this the feminine and all that has been de-emphasized in the Mother in Heaven. I really think a lot of it is the way that Mormonism is being presented to the outside world. I think to some extent it's a product of what Kendall White has referred to as Mormon neo-orthodoxy, the Mormon church trying to become more and more Protestant-like, not like liberal Protestant denominations, but more like fundamentalist Protestant denominations, like the Baptists, Southern Baptists, are moving toward greater inequality as far as women, and that's true for in the Catholic Church. And I think part of it is the church where the church is growing in appealing in terms of its proselytizing message is to the type of people who find the message of neo-orthodoxy more appealing, whereas talking about a Mother in Heaven is a heterodox thing. And as long as the church is successful in drawing converts from more traditional societies where women are trying to be held down or held in their place, I think the church is going to continue to be in that direction. I think what would change the church saying, hey, maybe we need to look at issues of feminine equality and a Mother in Heaven and stuff like that would be if all of a sudden the church stopped growing. And where we're going to draw new converts. It sounds crass. I think it's a question of marketing and who you're trying to appeal to.
We've actually come up on the end of our time. Margaret, did you want to? All right. I wanted to thank all of you for coming to this plenary session, for all of your questions. And please save them. Don't forget them, because those of us who are interested in gender and Mormonism want to continue hearing those questions to spur new conversations. I'd like to remind you that we do have a table with books at the back. Feel free to look through those. They're for sale. Those of you who pre-ordered lunch and have lunch tickets, your lunches are in the Coconino room directly across the hall directly out of this doorway. If you didn't order lunch, there are a few places, several places in the building that are open. And then, of course, all around the perimeter of campus, there are multiple restaurants that are open. Feel free to take your lunches, whether you brought them or whether you have a lunch ticket.
anywhere you'd like in the building or outside. It's a beautiful day, and we'll see you when we return.